Welcome, 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 everybody, to the Hockey Think Tank podcast brought to you by the hockeythinktank.com, a place where you go to get a little bit of this, a little bit of that, some of here, some of there. We got webinars. We got these things. We got those things. You want to get better, parent, coach, player? We got you. Hockeythinktank.com.
Oh, my God.
Pretty good. That's what you sound like if it was unprofessional. You sound awesome.
Oh, my God. If I sound like that, this podcast is done. We are stopping it right now.
No, I actually love when you do that little intro. I, like, dance to it while you do it. Makes me happy. That was my version of it.
Oh, man. I guess we should start putting the podcast on, like, YouTube or something like that and, like, film video sessions that we're doing.
I don't know. I'm usually not clothed for them, so they have to be rated PG, like, 14.
All right. Well, welcome to the Hockey Think Tank podcast tonight. We are on the fly here. Obviously, we had a little bit of a hiccup this morning putting out Noel Needham's podcast and then having to take it down. So at first, we want to address that, and then we'll get into a ton of questions. Thank you, everybody, that submitted questions through Twitter and through Instagram. And I even got a couple texts and a couple emails from some people, too, that had some questions. So really appreciate you all putting some time and effort and thought into some things that you want to hear from us. But I think first, before we do that, I think it'd be good to kind of address what happened with Noel. So, Jeff, kind of stinks, huh? That was an awesome interview.
Yeah. I mean, I messaged Noel right away and I was like, you know, I'm really sorry that this happened. We didn't mean to get you in trouble. We didn't even know this was a thing, really. And we weren't even really talking about the Maple Leafs. We're not going to talk about it again, obviously, idiot Jeff. We didn't ask her any questions that were, like, divulging club secrets or anything, but like you said to me off the air, it was a policy thing or something?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of NHL teams have policies where they don't want their, in-house hockey operations staff talking to the media, and for good reason. The hockey is an information-gathering business, and a lot of times teams want to keep a lot of their stuff pretty close to their vest and don't want to, you know, let their cards down too much. So a lot of teams have it. I think where we kind of didn't understand is we didn't really think we were media. We were just a couple of people talking hockey and trying to educate the public. But in other people's eyes, it sounds like we're part of the media now, and I think not only was it obviously a Maple Leafs policy, but I think because they have that policy, there were some people in the media that weren't very happy that, you know, we got quote unquote access to somebody in their hockey ops department when they might have felt like, you know, they don't get access to those kinds of people. So I get it. Kind of a learning experience here. We actually had some other people in the NHL lined up to talk to us, so we're going to have to certainly go through the proper channels to make sure that that's okay, because these people are very knowledgeable hockey people. Noelle was, I mean, she was so awesome. I haven't heard from people before the podcast came out, so many people so excited for a podcast. I think everybody was really excited to hear what she had to say. And, you know, obviously we did the interview and she was incredible. Just her story growing up on a ranch in South Dakota and some of the stories that she told about her family in terms of the way that she grew up and playing in the barn, you know. Her dad had made a rink inside her barn and only let them listen to AC/DC as they were out there training and stuff. That was pretty funny. And from there, you know, the stories that she told when she was at Shattuck St. Mary's, and, you know, she was able to hang out with guys like Zach Parise, and, you know, kind of they were given the keys to the rink by Zach's dad, JP Parise, where they would just go out and have fun and play hockey and develop just kind of organically the way that that we really believe in too. And talking about how she got the Maple Leafs job and talking about how, you know, she built up her hockey development company, Legends Hockey, which she's an entrepreneur, and she built that company from the ground up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, which I know there's a USHL team there, but there's not a ton of other hockey stuff going on there. So hearing the story about how she built that was incredible too. So I kind of just gave the cliff notes of what it was, because it was an amazing conversation. And I encourage everybody here, there are some articles out there about Noelle, about how she built her brand and stuff like that. I encourage you all to maybe even Google her, and because she is an inspiration. She's a definite inspiration. And what I said on the podcast was, you know, I have an 18-month-old daughter, and she's breaking glass ceilings right now. And the fact that, you know, my daughter in 20, maybe 30 years, there might be options there for her should she fall in love with the game like I have, and like you have, and like Noelle has. There might be opportunity for her in some of the highest levels of hockey. So we really appreciated Noelle for coming on, and it was a great conversation, and just kind of stinks that that not everybody was able to hear it.
Yeah, basically we got butt clapped, Toph. That's when somebody just claps your butt cheeks together. That's what happened to us. Because that, like you said, that conversation with her was awesome. Do you think there's any way, because we haven't even asked this, is there any way we could like send it to whoever in the Maple Leafs and be like, can we air this if you think it's okay? Or do you think it's just dead and we just need to blow it up?
No, to be honest, I think it's probably dead. I mean, rules are rules for a reason, right? And, I don't think Noelle got into trouble or anything. It was just an honest mistake. And, I guess we're part of the NHL media now. Maybe that's a good thing. No, I'm just kidding.
Hilarious.
But it is what it is. But we just wanted to kind of tell the story of what happened here today. And, it's unfortunate because Noelle's amazing and people would have learned a lot from her. But we understand that there's policies in place. And as much as it sucks, Jeff, I see your face right now. You're not buying it, but it is what it is. Yeah. So we can move on. But there was actually some news in the NHL today that was unfortunate as well, and that's Dave Hakstol got fired from the Philadelphia Flyers. Did you ever deal with North Dakota at all in your recruiting process or no?
How many D1 teams are there? Like 60 or 61?
There's 60 right now.
59? How many are there?
There's 60 right now with Penn State and Arizona State.
So there was 58 then when we were playing. So if I swear to God, I had to have had contact with probably 50 or 51 out of 58 where I talked to them at some point throughout my 3 years. It took me till like 2 months before the season was over to actually finally get a Scully. But North Dakota is one of the teams that I don't think I ever talked to.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Never talked to me.
Gotcha.
Not that one.
Well, Dave Hakstol is, he was an awesome guy, and it was really unfortunate to see the news here today that he got let go. And I just wanted to, tell a story because, you know, there's certain memories that you have throughout our journey that kind of stick out to you, you know, things that might have an effect on you. And one of the things I remember, we were down in Florida. It was my first year as a coach at Cornell. And we were at the coaches convention where all the coaches get together and do some professional development and talk about, you know, issues of, you know, NCAA hockey and stuff like that. And, Coach Hakstol, he actually took me aside. He said, "Hey, Toph, I just want to say something to you." I was like, "Oh, well, okay, Coach Hakstol from North Dakota. I'll talk to you." He's like, "Hey, I just want to let you know that I really love the way that you played. You played honest, you played hard, and, you know, I'm really excited for you that you're in the business. You're going to add a lot to college hockey." And I was like, holy crap. Like, that was unbelievable that he said that.
Oh, like, that is sick.
Yeah, thank you. I was like kind of blown away. And I was like, yeah, I mean, yeah. There's a reason why you are where you are and you're one of the top coaches in college hockey. Like, it was cool to kind of get that feedback from him and made me feel really good. So I just wanted to share that story because I know there's a lot of news, you know, positive, negative, all the above about him going on right now. I really appreciated that. As a coach, you want to touch other people's lives, you know, you want to make a positive impact. And he certainly did with me that day. So I just thought that was really cool and wanted to say that since I had that tough news here today.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool.
Yeah, so let's get to it, man. We got a ton of awesome questions from people. Jeff, you compiled a list here, so I think let's just let her rip. Let's just get right to it. What do you think?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, we had some really good questions. There's some of these will be more suited towards you, some will be me, but we'll both talk about them, I think, here. So let me throw up So I really like this one. It's from a guy named Ian Gindhart. He said, confidence is one of the most important attributes a player can have. What did you guys do to get your confidence back when you lost it? And how do you maintain it throughout an entire season?
That's a great question.
Great question. Huge question.
So you want me to take this one first, or do you want to go first?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay, so first I want to tell a funny story about confidence, because this is pretty good. Like, I'm a big believer that confidence is earned. You have to earn your confidence. It's not something you either have or you don't, and it's on a spectrum, right? You can get a little bit more, you can get a little bit less based on the things that you do on a consistent and daily basis. And, you know, I was coaching at a school, and I was coaching with a coach that his name rhymes with Shmiko Shmazi, and he's hilarious. And sometimes when he gets, like, upset with the guys, he gets kind of sarcastic, which as an assistant coach is, like, the hardest thing ever, because you have to keep a straight face, because sometimes the things that the head coaches say are, like, just really funny, but you can't laugh because he's giving it to the players. Awesome. But yeah. He went in there, and he did something to the effect of, like, you know, I'm hearing that, you know, all you guys are lacking confidence right now. And, you know, hey, coach, did you forget to go to Target and buy the guys confidence today and give it to them? Was Target out? Were they out? It's just like, it was pretty funny, but
that is funny.
But for me, again, confidence is earned. And I think there's two real ways that you get confidence. One is mastery of a skill. And two is having actual success that you can build off of. And both of those things come from hard work and building really good habits. So if you want a better shot and you want confidence in your shot, you have to work at it every day, right? So that's where the mastery of the skill comes in. And so if you want a better shot and you shoot 100 pucks every day, you're going to feel like your shot is better after, you know, not right away, but after a certain amount of time, you will feel like your shot is better and you will be a little bit more confident. You know, then because your shot is better, pucks will probably start going in more because you're getting your shot off quicker and it's harder and it's tougher for the goalie to save. So the mastery of a skill and the earning of a confidence and having success, I think that's everything. It's not something you have or you don't. That's a very easy thing to say. It is very hard as an athlete, especially at the higher levels, and in college hockey especially that we played, you got a lot of stuff going on, and you really have to manage your time well to make sure you're getting your reps in to get better and master your skill. So you have to be proactive in making sure that you have a plan to do those things on a day-to-day basis. It shouldn't come – the other thing is the best kind of confidence comes from yourself. That intrinsic confidence, that's real confidence. Extrinsic confidence, when, you know, somebody has to say something to you for you to get confidence, like, that's a load of crap. It isn't a load of crap in the sense that it feels really good when people say that you're doing something well. Like, that can give you, I think that's artificial kind of confidence. The confidence that you earn and you know you earn through your work, like, that's the confidence that really means something. And I think the best players, they earn their confidence. And that's a long-winded answer to that question, but it's something I'm very, very passionate about. And yeah, you got to go out and work for it.
I totally agree. I mean, I won't say it as poetically, but because you're a little more inteligente than me, but I'm going to echo pretty much the same thing. The way that I always built confidence for me was through habits, like Tove said, and practice. I've never been someone that bought into or believed, you know, you can practice half speed and then bring it the next day in the game. Like, every once in a while, okay, but that's going to catch up to you. Me being who I was, I always use myself as an example. I wasn't, like, super skilled, but I was super determined. So every day I treated practice like it was a game. And if you asked anyone I ever played with, like, I would finish every puck. I would stop on the net every time, like, because I just was like, I'm going to get better today and use this practice to literally build confidence so that when I'm scoring and stuff, I'm going to sell you like it's a real game. Like, I practiced the way I played. Because then I felt like that gave me confidence and took me into the game. Like, I've already done it, you know, over and over and over at the highest speed like you would in a game. Now I'm just confident bringing it to the game. Also, you know, I love the gym and training to be a hockey player, not a meathead, but like hockey specific strength. I started getting so confident in myself and my hockey through training and building my body up, knowing I was stronger than everyone else. Like, I guess if you just thought about you were going into a fight and they said your opponent could train 5 hours only, and then he had to go in the fight, but they told you you could train 100 hours. Well, you're going to be going to that fight thinking, I'm going to win this fight. I trained 100 hours and I know we only trained 5. That's kind of what my off ice to on ice. That's how I brought that in to get confidence. But the other part of that question he asked, I think, was super important. Confidence is everything, like we're talking about. What if you lose it? What if you have a couple bad games in a row? What would you do, Toph, to get back to a confident state of mind?
I think two things, work and fun. Because when you are not confident in your abilities, specifically going into hockey stuff, you got to find a way to make it fun. Because not being confident is not fun. And it's not easy to go through. So find a way to, like, you know, when you're doing your work, like, do it as a competition or as a game with somebody else that's on your team or something like that. And, you know, find a way to make it a little bit more fun, because I think at the end of the day, we all lose confidence at some point. Even the best players in the world who, you know, are confident bordering on cocky, there are times where they don't feel the most confident in themselves. So I think just getting back to work, focusing on fundamentals, not making it too crazy, and just having fun with it, and, you know, loving the game again. I think that's really important when you lose it. At least that's what I used to do. I wasn't very, like, there were times where I went through stretches where I thought I sucked at hockey. I think we all go through those times, but so those were kinds of things that I did and tried to impart upon the kids that I coached too.
Yeah.
How about you?
I'm along the exact same lines. For me, it was if I was ever in a, you know, in a slump, quote unquote, or I wasn't feeling good about my play. And by the way, you don't need to score to be good, but it makes everyone feel good when they score. I would always work harder. And like, you know, when you're in that slump, you know, a couple games go by, you stop having fun. Like you just said, make it fun. I literally would fake it. I always said, fake it till you make it. Like if you're not having fun, like I'd fake it. Like I'd go out there and like over try to have fun, over make things to be fun while also playing even harder, or staying out longer or whatever. And then, you know, I'd always find my way back to being confident, which then leads to playing well.
Yeah. And I wanted to go back to one of the things that you said when you were talking about training and out training other people. I want to take confidence to a team standpoint right now, because you can be confident as a team or not confident as a team too when you come in the rink and you go on the ice for games. And one of the things that I always subscribe to and we really relished as a team at Cornell was making sure that our practices were harder than our games. So by how hard we were competing against each other in practice, like the games, we wanted them to be easy, you know, because we competed so hard that, you know, when we went out there, nobody was going to compete as hard as we were going to. And we kind of took on that mantra from when I played at Cornell and even when I coached. And it was, you know, we're going to beat the crap out of each other in practice. We are going to try. And it's selfish. Like if you're not working hard in practice, you're not making me better. And that's a selfish thing for you to do, not being ready to come and practice. So bring it, because we're going to earn our swagger. We're going to earn our confidence by how hard we go against each other. And that in turn is going to give us confidence as we go in the game, because we know that they're not going to work as hard as us. We know that they didn't put in the time and effort from Monday to Thursday that we did. And because of that, we're going to be confident that we're going to go out there and beat the crap out of you, if that makes any sense.
I absolutely love that. And to keep going on that too, I know we're just going to keep talking about this the whole show, but I have another idea that we used to do in juniors. I did it in college. I did it on some of my pro teams. And I had a kid ask me on my U16 team that I trained the other day, ways to get scoring more goals. And I said, turn into a competition.
Yeah.
Grab another guy who, you know, you are even with, or he's better than you, or you're a little better than him, whatever, and make a weekly competition. You count every goal in practice and you hold each other accountable in between drills. You go, how many score that drill? You know, I got 2. All right. You're at 4. I'm at 6. At the end of practice, whoever has the most goals, they get a tally in the locker room. End of the week, that guy's got to buy the other guy a coffee, or, you know, if you're over 21, a beer or food or whatever, you know, and that makes practice fun and it makes you try harder. And then you get confidence because you start trying harder, you score more, all that stuff. Like it all goes together. So
yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that.
It is an ever evolving but ever present and very important question, and very glad that we got it. And hopefully some stuff that we said can resonate with some people, because it's a lot more fun to be playing when you're in a confident state of mind, that's for sure.
Oh, without a doubt. All right, we'll move on to another one here.
Yeah, what do
little
you got?
A little bit lighter one. Kevin Shear. I hope I'm saying that right.
Kevin Shire. What,
Shire. Oh, yeah. You know Kevy.
Kevin's dad is actually a legend at Cornell, and Kevin played at Union, so he was a really good player.
Oh, sweet. Yeah. All right, well, what's up, Shizey? Shizey says, what's the most important thing that needs to be changed in youth hockey? And he meant under 12.
Oh, man. What do you think?
Oof. I mean, what I'm going to say doesn't even have anything to do with hockey. I'm going to say put coaches and managers and all these people who are in these positions over these children at this crucial stage of hockey and life. Get people who are good people and understand that it's a game and they're learning and they're not there pushing the kids to win or, more importantly, yelling at the ref. Because what does that show? Like, you know, I used to ref when I was a kid and I ref those young games. And, you know, you're getting yelled at in a mic game and I'm, you know, barely older than the kids on the ice. Now I'm like afraid of adults. But looking back, I think it's okay to yell at somebody who's supposed to be in charge. Like, you know what I mean? I think just that culture of we should be here for the kids. We should be here to get them as better, make them better people, make them better players, learn their skills, have fun every single time they come to the rink. Not, you know, these crazy helicopter parents. That's what I would say what needs to change.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a culture thing. And I think the biggest thing is education. I really do. I really feel like, and that's part of the reason why we started this podcast and we started the Hockey Think Tank, was to educate people on the right way to develop kids. And it's not, you know, all about winning. You know, winning's great and kids should learn to be competitive and stuff like that. 100%.
Totally.
But at the same time, you know, an adult's ego is tied to a Pee-wee's win-loss record, you know?
Correct.
Is that right? No, it's not. I think another thing too, and I've been doing a lot of research into this, is that I think when we talk about development in hockey, we talk a lot about hockey. And I don't think we talk enough about teaching, you know? Like, people should read books about teaching and leadership and mentorship and stuff like that. Cause that's more important than any type of drill that I can
totally
draw up.
I mean, I did think that way, but I didn't know how to word it, I guess, until we had our talk with Adam Nicholas. When he said that about teaching and coming from that standpoint, I was like, man, like, you're coaching, but you should learn how to teach. Before you coach, because you can have all of the right information in your head, but if you can't disseminate that, if you can't get that to your players and your parents and everything to get everyone on the same page, it doesn't matter what your knowledge is. If you're saying A and they're hearing B, you're not getting through to them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know,
learning
about communication and teaching methods and just things like that, I think go way, way, way. They're so undervalued and I think they're so important to development. And I've been trying to do more research on it. I've been trying to learn more about it. And I think I'll become ultimately a better coach and whatever I want to get into down the road, based on just learning about that, you know, the soft skills, let's call them, and things like that. So I think that's something that needs to change too. People need to focus a little bit more on that side of thing than on, you know, actual hockey stuff, even though the hockey stuff's important. I'm not saying like, you know, don't learn about that, but you know, the education side of thing, I think is huge.
That's great. And I want to clear something up too, because, you know, you and I are on the same page with teaching the game and teaching the skills and we, you know, not the parents not caring so much about winning. I got to say, like, Topher and I, if we're doing anything, we don't want to lose and we want to effing win. Like, and I want my kids to feel that way. Like, I'm not saying when I say these things about youth hockey and the culture, I want them to want to win, right? I want them to learn how to battle, to learn how to have that, you know, you're going to have to kill me to get over me, like, spirit. Like, yes, you have to teach them and nurture that and everything. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, you know, it should be the game. You battle your ass off. The game's over. Okay, you can shake hands with the other team and everything's fine. You leave the rink. It's not the end all be all. If you lose one game, you don't need to slap your kid in the face. Like, it doesn't matter if they drop from ranked 22nd in the nation to 36th when they're 7.5. That stuff doesn't matter. Like, You know what? Does that make sense? What I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Because like I still want that battle. I don't want like the wussification of hockey. Like I learned to battle my ass off in hockey, and I try and bring that into life. I'm not trying to lose that, but it's that other garbage that comes.
At the Scott thinking. Family Thanksgiving and Christmas parties, we would have a shinny tournament, and there would always be somebody that was bloody, and always be somebody that was crying every year. And usually it was like our parents.
usually it was Uncle Tim that was crying.
That's true. Yeah. But no, I'm with you. I think compete level is something that's important too. So that can't get lost. I feel you.
Right. Yeah. You just got to learn how to, I guess like what you just said, like learn how to teach before you coach so that you can properly coach and teach and infuse the message that we want to battle. But like if we lose today, we're not losers, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. That was poetic. Good work.
All right. Yeah. Say thanks. Shizey. That was a great question. Thanks, Kevin Shire. Let's see here. Jack Larrigan asked, what do players have to do or develop in order to keep moving up the ladder in hockey?
I think this is probably one for me.
let's go with the IQ guy.
Being on the other side of things, what do they need to do? They need to play for a good coach, number one. They need to play for a coach that cares about them as a player, as a person. They need to play for a coach that is passionate about hockey and passionate about the kids. They need to play for a coach that has, you know, a history of, you know, moving players on and a history of, you know, players that I think the ultimate test of a coach, honestly, is if your kid wants to go to the practice every day, you're doing something right. You know, it doesn't even matter if you're, I mean, I shouldn't say that, like you need to learn stuff and things like that. But if your kid is excited to go to practice, like your coach is doing his job. And so I think number one is play for a good coach. I think number two is you have to learn how to become resilient. I think that is one of the most important skills that you can have as a kid today, because things don't always go your way. They hardly ever do. You and I know that better than anybody else. And, you know, I can tell the story about when I was a senior in high school. It was my grade 12 year. And there's a tournament called the Fall Classic, the USHL Fall Classic. We were playing in the USHL at the time. And I led the preseason tournament in scoring. And at that tournament, every single college coach is there. Like, every single coach is there. And after the tournament, it was honestly, like, it was one of the coolest feelings, because there was, like, every school that I ever wanted to go to was lined up to talk to me. And I was so excited. It was really cool. A week later, I tore my ACL. First game of the season, tore my ACL, done for basically the year. And every single school except for one stopped talking to me. And that was a total punch in the gut. Thank God I have great parents that, you know, said, hey, this is just a minor setback and you are going to come out of this better than you were before. And your attitude and how you approach this injury is going to determine how far you end up going in the hockey world. And honestly, I can sit here and tell you right now that tearing my ACL as a 17-year-old is probably one of the best things that ever happened to me, because I learned how to become resilient. And for all the kids out there, especially with recruiting being so young, you and you alone will determine your destiny. It may not come in the time frame that you want it to, and it's certainly going to have peaks and valleys, but at the end of the day, if you can learn that the little blips and the tough times, if you can learn that those are actually a good thing and can teach you more things than any kind of success can do, you will get to where you want to go. I shouldn't say you will, but you will certainly put yourself in a better position to get to where you want to go.
That's awesome. Love it. Absolutely love it. Brought a tear to my eye. Reminded me when you're going through that, and you're right, came out, you know, smarter, stronger, tougher, more resilient. And that's everything. We've talked about my story before, so people have heard that in the first episode of this, have heard that. So I'm not going to go through it again, but yeah, you know, those are the things that make you who you are when you're, especially like when you're not that, you know, Jack Hughes or that generational talent or that unbelievable guy who's going to go first. Like everybody else, you're going to go through way more ups and downs. You're not a genetic freak. You're not whatever it is that they have, that inequality. Like you need to be resilient. You have to be resilient if you're going to keep going up the ladder. That was great. Well, we'll just leave it at that, 'cause that was a great answer.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, nicely done. Oh, I love this question from Rod. I believe this is from Twitter. He didn't give his last name.
Rod the Bot.
Well, I wish it was from – well, no, we wouldn't be able to ask this question.
He's Rod Brindamore, yeah, we can't talk to
he's
them.
He's an NHL personnel, so we would get pee-pee slapped. Rod said, are advisors necessary? And if not, what can you do to move up the junior ranks in college? Great question.
I get this question like once a week. I'm sick of it. No, just kidding.
I mean, this is one that I always get when I'm when I begin new client meetings with, you know, like 14, 15, 16 year old AAA guys in St. Louis. Does he need an advisor? Who should he be with?
So the answer to the question is no, you do not need an advisor. You do not
straight
need
out of an ex-D1 college coach's mouth.
You know, so whenever I get asked this question, it's always in a connotation that advisors are terrible people. Like that's kind of how people always ask it. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's not true either. There are plenty of advisors out there that care about their kids, that help their kids navigate the process. Because it's crazy. There's a ton of junior leagues. There's 60 Division I college teams. There's major junior. There's prep school. There's a ton of different midget teams. I mean, it's youth hockey is kind of nuts. And sometimes it could be good to have a little bit of help to kind of navigate that process. But no, I don't think you need an advisor. You need a strength coach. If you want to pay money, pay for a trainer that's going to help you get bigger and stronger. Maybe pay for a skills coach if you have the money to be able to do it, to get better. You need to just focus on yourself and get better. And I can tell you as a former Division I assistant, and every single college coach will tell you the same thing, if you're good enough, you will be found. I can literally, if I get a tip on a kid in St. Louis, I can call 6 to 7 different people and get a report on who that kid is and how good they are at hockey. If there's a kid in Chicago, I can talk to 20 different people in Chicago. If it's a kid in British Columbia, Canada, I can talk to 15 different people out there. If it's Ontario, I can talk to 15 people out there. Our networks are so long and wide, and a huge part of our job as college assistant coaches is being on the phone, developing relationships with people in different areas around North America so we can assess and get the most amount of information on the kids that are out there. So no, you do not need an advisor. Are all advisors bad people? No, there are some very good ones that really care about the kids and actually can do a very good job for them. But at the end of the day, do you need one? No, you do not need one.
Great answer. I'll come from a little bit different angle because I agree with that. Most kids don't need one. I will tell you that I think that I like what you said about if you want some money to spend, only a little whatever, I would invest in a strength and conditioning coach, one that you know is knowledgeable about the body and, if possible, knowledge about hockey. Because I mean, you know, we had Mike Boyle on 2 weeks ago, and he's one of the best hockey trainers of all time, I think, and he never played hockey. So obviously there are people who can do it that are so smart, but I think it takes a lot to know what's demanded from hockey to be a good strength coach for hockey players. So I'll say that. So if you only have a little bit of money, spend it on him, on a strength coach. That will help you more. But if you're somebody who has money, extra money in your whatever budget for your kid, and he's 16 and he's a good player, he's not great, I would get an advisor. I would do my homework only because I wouldn't, if you have the extra money, because I look at it this way. I always said to myself, do everything I can so I never look back and have a regret. If you think that, you know, there's an advisor who's got a great reputation and is helping kids and is a good person, and your kid's like maybe on the bubble and he really wants to be a hockey player, I mean, what's the worst that happens? You give him some money and nothing happens, or you give him some money and something great could come of it. And I'm not saying that I love advisors, because like I didn't need one, you didn't need one. But if I had money to spend and my kid loved hockey and wanted to get better and he was kind of on the bubble, I would do what I could to help him. Does that make sense or no?
Yeah, no, that makes sense for sure. And let me add to that a little bit. If you do want to get an advisor, okay, make sure you do your homework and you do your research, and in your interview process with that person, go with the advisor that is the most honest with you. Okay. So if the advisor is telling you about all these crazy things that he can do for your kid, and I know this guy and this person and that person and blah, 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 not the guy for you, okay? If you're interviewing an advisor and he can tell you straight up and will look you in the eye and say, these are your kid's strengths and weaknesses, this is where your kid needs to get better, this is how I think he should get better, and he's honest with you and isn't blowing, blowing you a...
I'll get you here, I'll get you there, I'll get you this.
Exactly, right? Like, that's the kind of people that you want to surround yourself with, is the people that are honest with you and will give you a fair assessment of, you know, what you need to do to get to where you want to go. And if ultimately that goal is, you know, the NHL or college hockey or junior hockey or whatever it may be, you're going to get there by honest evaluation and knowing what your strengths and weaknesses are so you know what to work on to get better. And the best advisors are the ones that are honest with you. They're no BS and they tell it like it is, and that's it. They're not the people that promise you they can get you to this league and this team and that team. They're the ones that are just honest with you and tell you what you need to do to get better.
And aren't charging you an insane amount of money, because that's a joke.
Yes, that too.
And I'm not, I know that totally came off like I'm pro advisor. I was always told I didn't need one. I didn't get an agent until I won't call him an agent because you can't do that. I didn't get an advisor till my sophomore year of college. He's really an agent. You don't pay him unless you sign, and I did, luckily. But, people were approaching me when I was – right the year before I moved in with you. So when I was 14, I had advisors approaching me, and I was told I didn't need one, and I didn't. But looking back and how bad I wanted it, like if I was a kid who was on the bubble and my parents had extra money, like – if I was a parent in that situation, I would personally pay for it to do anything I could to help my kid, without overstepping, obviously. But I would first, obviously, strength coach and skills coaches like Brandon Arado at TPH. I mean, I love that guy. You know that he puts up videos like you and the way he thinks. Like, you can invest in someone that can develop your overall game, not just a skating coach or not just a skills coach or not, like someone that develops everything. That's who you want to also pay to help your kid.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, I think we should probably end it, but at the end of the day, it's about how good you are as a player and a person. That's going to determine where you go. It's not about, who knows who, or anything like that. If you are good enough, you will be found. I promise you that.
Yes, that is true. I have one more question I really wanted to ask because somebody asked it of me to ask you, and I want to hear what you have to say. So do we got time for one more?
Yeah, we got plenty of time, man.
Oh, okay. All right, cool. So this one comes from a friend of mine, actually, Andy Kantrowitz. He asked, how was your performance or preparation affected by different coaching motivational styles throughout your career? What style of coaching consistently gave you the biggest boost in terms of effort, focus, performance, et cetera, as a player? Was it kind of someone who screamed and yelled at every mistake, someone quieter, calmer, soft-spoken? Like, what drove you to be your best from a coaching motivational style?
That's a great question.
Yeah, that's why I was like, ooh, I got to ask that one.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is like personally, right? Like, what, as a player?
For you, yeah.
I always appreciated coaches that were passionate about hockey, number one, because I was too. So, and passionate about people. So I knew that he kind of cared about me. And one of the best coaches that I ever had was a guy named Will Nickel, who I played for in Chicago with the Steel. And he's now the, director of player development actually for Vegas. So he's big time.
Oh, wow. I remember Will. I didn't know that. That's so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's one of the best people in the business, and I consider him a mentor, and he did so much for me as a player, as a person. And I think the reason why I have so much respect for him is because he really cared about me. Like, I know that because he did things above and beyond any other coach that I ever had in terms of getting to know me, in terms of holding me accountable, telling me why he was holding me accountable. I remember, so he was my coach my last year, junior, and we weren't playing very well, and I was the captain of the team at the time, and I remember him.
Not a big deal.
No, it's actually not a big deal. But I remember him bringing me into the office, and he gave it to me. He was like, hey, you need to be better right now. Like, the team needs you to be better. Like, I know you have a lot more in you, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I got it. And then he goes, and I'm going to do something right now. He's like, I'm going to go into the room, and I am going to, in front of your teammates, absolutely blast you. And I'm going to be negative. I'm going to be mean. I'm going to give it to you in front of your teammates. I just want you to know, yes, I do want you to get better, but this isn't about you. This is about the team, and this is about sending a message to everybody. I know you can handle it, and the way that you react to how mean I'm going to be to you right now is going to be a huge effect to how the team is going to react to me giving it to them and holding you guys accountable. So I need you, as I'm giving it to you, to hold your head high and have the best practice you've ever had. And I was like, wow, okay, I'm in. So he goes in and he just absolutely rips me in front of the team. And I had to take it, and I deserved it, and we deserved it. But we went out and I made sure that I was positive, and I worked the hardest I've ever worked in that practice. And I just, it's just a story I'll always remember. And it's just things like that that made him such a great coach. And those were the guys that I think got the most out of me. The ones that I knew that cared about me, the ones that took time to get to know me and were just passionate about me, my team, and hockey in general.
Do you hear that? That's my mind being blown right now. That is unreal. I got goosebumps from that story.
I was actually like, I was getting kind of emotional as I was talking. Dude, I was telling that story.
That was a psychological thriller. That was unbelievable. Like, he totally mind effed your team and brought you in on, wow, love it.
Yeah.
That was probably the best practice ever.
I'm sure it was. I mean, I don't remember, but
you had to be like going a billion miles an hour.
I think so.
Oh my God.
And he was the kind of guy too. Like, he's actually the reason why I went to Cornell. Like, he was the one that, you know, he thought it was going to be a great fit. He knew the coaching staff. He knew me as a person. He knew I would fit in with the culture that they had there. And, you know, he was the one that really encouraged me to go. And I had a couple other options. And he was like, hey, I think this is the place for you. And I trusted him with my life. My parents trusted him. And I ended up going to Cornell. It was the best decision I ever made. So, you know, developing that trust by getting to know people and just caring about them, I think that's what Will had in spades. That's the reason why he is where he is right now. You know, one of the top jobs and on a team that lost in the Stanley Cup Finals last year as an expansion team. Like, come on. And he's just a great person, great human. And at the end of the day, that's what the best coaches are. They're great people.
Wow. What's money?
What
good
about
for
you?
Him. Yeah,
what
I remember
about
him.
You?
He was a great guy. Real quick, what were the other teams that you were talking to in college?
To be honest, it's funny. Like, I didn't want to leave the Midwest. I grew up in Chicago and kind of wanted to stay closer to home. I mean, you know my family situation, having brothers with special needs. Like, I didn't really want to be too far away, but the only schools that really wanted me were ones out east. So I took visits to Vermont. I took visits to Princeton and Brown too, but at the end of the day, Cornell was the spot. I actually almost went to Vermont. I was very close to going to Vermont. But on the, you know, I went and took my visit and thought it was great. And they had a lot of success. Marty St. Louis went there and, you know, for obvious reasons, I really looked up to him. But you know, 2 weeks after I took my visit, the head coach stepped down. So it was, I was like, ooh, I don't know. That's probably not the best spot. And then I went on my visit to Cornell and fell in love with it. And then that was it.
Boom. Roasted.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. How about you? What are the best coaches that you had, like, that got the most out of you?
I mean, Mike Hastings, obviously, we talked about him. He got a lot out of me. Minnesota State Mankato head coach. Unbelievable coach. But love that mind games, you know, psychological and all that stuff. And when I was younger, that worked for me because I was scared of him. But, like, he did such a good job of Herb Brooksing us that, like, I mean, Herb Brooks was his mentor. Like, we went and saw a private showing of Miracle when it first came out.
No way, really?
That was just for our team. They, like, did it just for us or whatever. And, yeah, but it was hilarious. I remember we saw that movie and literally, like, 10 sayings that Herb Brooks says in that movie, Hastings says them all the time. So, like, every 5 seconds we were turning around looking at him and he's laughing.
That's pretty good.
You know, because I didn't know who Herb Brooks was. I had no idea, you know. And then these sayings were, like, turn around, like, dude, you say these to me every day. Lavecchio, you look like a monkey effing a football all the time. You know. Lavecchio, my daughter's wet farts are tougher than you. Told me that a couple times. Oh, no, I think he told us his age, too. Oh, back you. My four-year-old daughter's wet farts are tougher than you. Unreal. But he, like, whether he did or didn't, I mean, I think he did. Like, would manipulate you so well that like he cared about you, and like it was like you wanted to impress him so much. And then like he'd be just screaming at you and going crazy on you, but in a way that like it motivated you. Most of us, there were guys who it didn't, but most of us. And I mean, you know, if he would have said like go jump in front of a bus, like I would have jumped in front of a bus. You know, it was, so that worked. But then also I played for a guy named Kevin Hartzell my first year in Norway with Lillehammer.
Yep.
And he's kind of an unconventional coach, unconventional guy. Unbelievable human being. I became really close with him. You know, I was the team voted me the captain, but because I didn't speak Norwegian, I decided to take the A and give a Norwegian guy the C. But I mean, I was pretty much the captain of that team, and Kevin and I would talk almost all the time before practices. What are the guys feeling? And because he cared about what the leaders thought the pulse of the team was, what the energy was for the day. He pretty much left everything up to us. If he did something and we didn't like it, we as leaders could go to him and we could change it together with him. And then he'd bring that to the team and coach us. So that, you know, one style was like so like laissez-faire and like let the guys run it. And then one was like dictator, like you will bow down before me. And both got really good results out of me. So for me, it's kind of like, I don't know, I just kind of do whatever the coach says because I don't have enough skill to like do whatever I want. So that probably actually honestly helped me with getting coaches being able to get the most out of me now that I'm thinking about it, because I know guys who are super skilled who play for coaches who couldn't think the game they could the way they could. And then they're telling them to be a robot. And then that skill guy is like, well, I can do this. Why are you making me do something remedial? So I guess coach the way a player needs to be coached. Everybody's different. That's my philosophy.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I know that's yours too. Like, sort of psychology. You can't throw a blanket statement and everybody's going to be motivated. The way I train in my company and the way I coach ever since I got into it 10 years ago in the summers was just like find out what each kid's buttons are and press them.
Yeah, 100%. Totally agree. Cool. Well, I got a question here too, that I thought was really good. And, this is actually coming from a guy named Shane Tallarico, who is a Division III assistant coach at Skidmore. Great guy. And, he had a question. It was,
Rico.
What's that?
I said, Uncle Rico. Isn't that the uncle's name in, Napoleon Dynamite?
I think it is. Yeah.
I think it is.
Yeah. Okay. So his question, this is for, you know, some of the hockey people out there. In the last couple of years, there's been changes in the D zone and neutral zone defensively. With that said, teams are trying to find the new way to create offense, you know, having the D come down, changing the size of the ice. What do you think will be the next big thing in the O zone to create offense? So I thought that was a really interesting question. Having just come from pro hockey, you played over in Europe and Asia and stuff. Were they doing anything really differently over there before I kind of give what I think might be the next thing?
Anything differently? I mean, I don't know. Like, last few years, D-men have been really jumping up in the play. Like, you know, they've been saying that for, like, 10 years. But, like, last few years, it's like D-men are all – there's, like, it's always four guys going, like, always. I mean, a lot more guys are using the net. Power plays are using the back of the net. I loved running power plays behind the net. I just think it's so – because I would – I played on the penalty kill my whole life, and I always know that when you like go behind the net, it's hard because you're looking, you got to look back, and then you lose where guys are, and then guys start crisscrossing and all that, and the high tips I would do a lot more of. That's pretty much all I have seen.
Gotcha. So I threw this question to this is another thing. If you want to get better, like coaches, we need to get better. Just as we ask our players to get better, you should expect the same out of yourself. And so I have a couple different like text groups and text chains that I'm in, which is people that I feel like are smarter than me. I always want to surround myself with people who are, you know, who know what they're talking about. So I have a couple different text chains with people in the business just to even just throw these kinds of questions to, and we'll share articles and stuff like that. I think that's really important, and you should always, you know, professional development is a huge thing. So I sent this question to a group that I'm in, and one of the things that guys started talking about was positionless hockey. So not necessarily three forwards and two D, but having players with the capability to play all five positions out there on the ice. And you talk about D getting up in the play and being a part of the offense and the rush and even the cycle and things like that. You know, I think people are starting to talk about that a little bit. I don't know if it's necessarily, and the group kind of agreed that it's not necessarily maybe the next big thing, but, you know, maybe 5, 10, 15, 20 years down the road, positionless hockey or, you know, more kind of roles instead of left wing, right wing, center, lefty, right D, you know, that could be something that could be coming up the pipe here at some point in the future. So I see you kind of being like, interesting. What do you think about that?
I love that. I mean, I still think that there's going to be a need for naming what a guy is because of faceoffs and stuff. Like, I don't think they're never going to get rid of faceoffs. But I mean, totally, like, for sure, the hardest teams for me to play against as a winger, as a left winger primarily, is when the puck's on your side and you're shoulder checking, where's my D-man, where's the puck, where's my D-man, where's the puck? You look back, where's D-man? Oh, shit, he just jumped down to the net. Like, most teams aren't doing that, but now all of a sudden teams are doing that all the time. And then as he jumps down to the net, the opposite D, who would be the left D, is coming over towards the middle. So then you're like, am I going to go down and leave my point open where now the right D has slid over and now he's going to be wide open? Or do I stay here and now that D-man just went to the net and my D-man don't know where he is? Maybe he's going to get free and have a little breakaway. So, like, those teams that, like, play, like, that rolling, just, like, always rolling positions, like, Red Bull was so good at that last year in the Austrian League, and, you know, a lot of professional teams are starting to do that, man. It's hard to defend when guys aren't just, like, static.
Yeah. 100%. Tampa Bay does that so well. Oh my God, yeah. I love watching Tampa Bay play. I mean, you look at their D, they're always in and out and up and back and joining the rush and getting back. And, you know, you see them, it's exciting. It's really, really exciting to watch that kind of hockey. And I think hockey is, you know, for a lot of different reasons, everybody's talking about how to develop more offense. And I think that kind of creates chaos. A lot of people talk about creating chaos. How can you create chaos, right? And that's one way to do it is, you know, activating your D and, you know, having, you know, a little bit of a plan, but also letting your guys kind of do their thing. So, I thought that was a really cool question. I got another question here too. What is the cause? This is from Dan Sutterman. What is the cause for the increase in high-end U.S.-born talent? Eichel, Gaudreau, Matthews, Hughes, etc. And where do you think Team USA finishes in the Olympics if held in 2022?
Sutsy, great question, Suts.
Oh, guy you know.
No, I don't. But imagine what it'd be like if I did, though, right?
Hooey! Imagine what that Veronica Vaughn.
That's a great question, Sutsy. I think, you know, coaching over the last 10, 15, 20 years, I'm sure TOEFL would be better off with timelines and dates, but it seems like what we're kind of talking about here now, people are like excited to talk about how do we get better? How can we do this? How can we do that? How can we improve this? How can we improve that? In every facet, every area of the game, on ice, off ice, mental, physical, all of these things. And 15 years ago, there was none of that. It was just like, oh, well, this guy's coaching the NHL for 500 years. Let's just keep going with him because he has experience. And there was so much of that. And it felt like such a kind of like a good old boys network. And now it's like, you know, you're seeing guys like John Cooper and people like that that are not only breaking through but succeeding. And they're having these different trains of thought that aren't just so old school hockey. And now it's just opening up just every possibility. Well, we'll try a stats guy like Moneyball. Like, we'll try this. We'll look at this. And then kind of piecing together what works best. And it just keeps going every day. What's the next thing to make everyone better? And so I think that's why the U.S. is really, like, really pushing players out, you know, in the USA National Development Program. I mean, I personally know so many kids from St. Louis that went in there, boys, and they come out two years later, and they're not even men. They're robots. I mean, not like emotionally, just physically, like they're X-Men. They come out and it's just like, what the hell did you just do? Who are you? Like they turn into just absolute animals. And a lot of these guys that we're seeing that are American are coming out of that. So that's a huge part too.
Yeah. I love this question for a couple of different reasons. Cause I might go on a little bit of a rant here.
Do it. So, I dare you.
So, for one, I agree with you that the National Development Program is a big part of the reason why you have some of the high end talent type. Even in the question that he had, you know, three of the four people, Eichels, Matthew, and Hughes, they're going to be number one overall draft picks. All three of them came from the National Development Program. I think the ability to get the best players in the country together and to compete against each other on a day-to-day basis with the kind of resources and coaching that are there, I think that's pretty special to be able to do that. So that's I agree with you on that. That's number one. Honestly, I think the biggest answer for this is a guy by the name of Wayne Gretzky. When Wayne Gretzky was traded to the Los Angeles Kings in whatever year it was in the early 90s, hockey in the U.S. started to boom. And now you're opening up the player pool to so many more athletes and kids to fall in love with the game. And I think if there's anything that USA Hockey has done a very good job of, along with the NHL, is expanding to these markets and getting kids to fall in love with playing hockey. You know, Austin Matthews would not be Austin Matthews if he was born in 1980, you know? So I think when Wayne Gretzky got traded, and you know, you're seeing it in college now. I recruited a kid from San Diego, California, and we had kids from our team from Texas, and we had kids on our team from Florida and Colorado and all these, you know, non-traditional hockey markets that when the NHL expanded, you know, that got more players into the pool. So that, I think that's a huge part of the reason why, and here's where I'm going to go on a little bit of my rant right now, because this is something that I'm passionate about and really pisses me off, is the cost of hockey right now. If it continues to go in the way that it is, you're going to see this disappear. You're going to absolutely 100% see it disappear, because the reason why there are so many good hockey players is because there's so many good athletes that are choosing to play hockey. Okay, you can tout the ADM, and I think the ADM has done a very good job, but you can tout that all you want. If you don't get kids into the system to do the ADM, then you're not going to get as many players with an opportunity to be the next, you know, Jack Eichel, you know, Jack Hughes, Austin Matthews, if that makes any sense. So if the cost of hockey continues to rise at the rate that it is doing, you're not going to see that anymore. Like, and it's going to be a long, slow process, but at the end of the day, you're cutting kids out, and you're cutting very good athletes out of being able to play in the sport. And you got people paying upwards of $25,000 a year to play AAA hockey in some areas of the country. Like, you really are. Let's call a spade between the travel and the coaching. I mean, you have coaches and hockey directors that are making six figures for coaching a midget team. Okay. Good. Like, I wasn't making nearly that much as a Division I assistant coach in college. Yeah, plenty of
teams are looking for new coaches. My number is.
So, I don't know what the right answer. I don't know if there's anything USA Hockey can do to curb the costs, because at the end of the day, it's a capitalistic society that we live in. So, what kind of rules can you sanction when it comes to that kind of thing? Or, you know, what kind of rules can you put in place to all these privatized arenas where people are coming in and buying these public arenas and then jacking the prices up from an hourly rate to an absorbent amount of money, so now people have to pay more money to get there and play. I don't know what the answer is to that. Maybe that's a podcast for another time, but I think it's amazing right now that with Wayne Gretzky getting traded, that just opened up the player pool, and now really good athletes were starting to play hockey. But because the cost is where it's getting to right now, that's one of my biggest fears about the sport that I love so much, is that it's going to cut really good athletes and really good people out of hockey because they just can't afford it anymore. Rant done.
Boom. Whole world roasted. First of all, I love, you know, this is why I like this, what we do here, and like you text people and talking to other people. Like, I came at it from like this thinking standpoint, the way I was thinking, and you came at it from like a whoa, like totally like macro picture, and what, like, so true. Like, Gretzky blew it up. That was awesome. And then the second point, hockey's getting so expensive, it literally makes me want to throw up all over myself and then eat it and throw it up again, because it's so gross how expensive hockey is. It's like, went in the store the other day and skates are $1,000. Like, what? What? Sticks are $300, and we know how many sticks break. I mean, maybe a little conflict of interest here, but that's the reason I started working for a hockey stick company called Humble Hockey. They used to be Bardowski, changed their name to Humble Hockey because they can make sticks that are literally almost identical to the big brand names. I can't say them. Like, they come out of almost the same factory, if not the same factory, and they sell them for less than half the price because they don't care about making that massive profit like the big guys do. And that grosses me out. Like, come on, hockey. Like, literally, we're going to lose athletes. We're losing athletes. There are kids who literally can't afford to play hockey.
Yeah, 100%.
Because it's so expensive. It's gross. And you know how we could cut the cost too, by the way? All you dumb organizations, stop making kids go out of town every weekend.
Yes.
Play some games at home. Take some weekends where you just practice. You don't need to play 75 games as a 14-year-old kid. You'd be way better off working out 2 to 3 times a week, playing against teams in your area, or having practice on the weekend than playing games every freaking weekend.
Imagine what you can do with that $1,000, because let's say it's $1,000 to fly from St. Louis to Detroit and get 2 hotels and meals and all that kind
yeah.
of stuff. Imagine what you can do for your kid with that $1,000 in terms of hiring a great strength coach or hiring a skills coach during the summer or just, you know, whatever. Something that's going to actually benefit your kid.
That's like a half a season worth of workouts from a strength coach or more, you know, a little more. Like, you could do so much with that. That's one trip. Like, what if you do that multiple times a year? You know, like, you don't have to go out of town all the time. And coaches, your kids will get way better by doing off-ice workouts. That doesn't mean they need to be lifting weights. If they're young kids, they don't got to lift weights. But there are so many things they can do to become better athletes, which then will make them better hockey players. They won't be as high as at as high of a risk for injuries because they're not always skating. Like, come on. It's the parents' pride and coaches' pride. Oh, we got to go to this tournament. We got to beat this team. Oh, no. Let's make these kids better.
What was that?
You
cut out a little bit there. What was that last thing you said?
I said, I don't know. Let's care about the kids and what's going to make them better. And playing 3 more games every month will not make them better. That's not the one, you know, they could have so many more. Ugh. You know how I feel about this.
I do. Well, I feel the same way, 100%. And being a midget coach this year has really opened my eyes to a little bit of the craziness that's going on. And just talking to different people and seeing it firsthand has been pretty crazy. But develop a passion for the game. And to be able to develop a passion for the game, you have to have opportunities for kids. And the more the cost keeps going up, the less opportunity people are going to have. And that really grinds me. What are the right answers? You know, that's a podcast for another day. There's probably a lot of them out there, and I'd love to talk to people that think they have them. If you do, email me, topher@thehockeythinktank.com, because that's something that I'm really passionate about and hope to change, that's for sure.
That's topher@thehockeythinktank.com.
What do we got next, Johnny?
We got time for another one or no?
I think we're good, man. I think unless you got a, you know, super duper crazy one.
There's a lot of good ones, but I'll just save them. I have them in the email that I sent them to you.
We'll do this again.
If we didn't get to answer your questions or tell you our opinions on the questions you have, we definitely have them saved in an email, and we'll do this again sometime if people like it. Give us feedback, and we'll bring them out in the next mailbag.
Yeah, definitely. We would love some feedback from everybody. So let us know how we're doing. Let us know what we can do to get better. So, if you're subscribed to the podcast, it's great. But shoot us a rating and give us a review, and that'll really help us out to try and make the podcast better. And that's what we're all about and what we're trying to preach to everybody. So, again, appreciate everybody that submitted some questions and really appreciate everybody that's been tuning into the podcast. So hope you all have a great week, and we look forward to bringing on some more great people here soon.